You are listening to the For the Bros Tech Podcast, episode 256. There's nobody in the driver's seat of the live stream.
Welcome to season 6, episode, let me get this right, 1000000000 in binary. Also sometimes referred to as 256 in base of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is August the 14th. No, 21st, 2016. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and having been around for at least 30 years of my life is my brother James Furlough.
Yeah, that's right. You had a birthday last weekend. Happy birthday. You're the big 3-0. How's it feel to have entered a new decade? Do you feel old and decrepit and like a Luddite now?
Yeah, a little bit. I'm tired of all these kids and their apps.
Their Pokemon Goes.
That's exactly. Their Snapchat.
Snapchats, the Googles. Exactly. That's pretty old too, actually. Now
yeah, I was gonna say,
and had a date, which we may or may not talk about later. I don't even know if it rose through our the ranks.
It's so painful. I don't even want to. Yeah, this is one of our last episodes on Google Hangouts.
Yay! We'll be doing Google Duo from now on. Oh wait,
yeah,
no, we won't. No, anybody won't.
Yeah, right? It's just... Oh, gosh.
So 30. Did you do anything fun?
I did. I went to Boston for a week.
Oh, well, there you go.
Actually, I'm doing a couple of different things. I'm not the sort of person that's like, your birthday should last the whole month. I just kind of accidentally stumbled into it this year that I'm doing that. So we went to Boston just for fun, to visit the city. See the places, do the things. It's actually really cool because it's like there's so much history going on in that city. You just accidentally stumble upon
what
stuff.
Happened in Boston. Red Sox. That's all I really know.
We did get to see the Red Sox, but it's like one of the first.
Is that where they? Is the Liberty Bell there?
No, that's Philadelphia.
Okay.
So
is that where the first settlement was?
No, that's Plymouth Rock.
Okay.
Jamestown is the oldest living one. I'll give you a hint. So one of the nights we walked into a bar and had a beer there called the pub was called the Green Dragon. And
the Green Dragon,
we didn't realize the significance of drinking at the Green Dragon until a couple of days later when we found out Paul Revere, who lived in Boston, was drinking at the Green Dragon with a bunch of other guys one night. Complaining about taxation without representation, and decided
that's what you do
exactly, and decided to take the couple of blocks walk from the Green Dragon down to the harbor
because he was dressed slightly inebriated,
dressed in Indian costumes, and take a bunch of tea and throw it into the
I thought that was going to be his ride.
No,
it was interesting.
Yeah, it was a. It was
tea party moment.
It was, yeah, the literal tea party. Yeah, so that was the Boston Tea Party. We did get to go to the Old North Church, where one if by land, two if by sea, and
the lantern was lit.
Yeah, we got
that's pretty cool seeing places with all that history.
Yeah, it was really neat.
Like anyone in Europe listening to this is like,
yeah,
history.
It was like last year. I know. Whatever. We got to go to the Bunker Hill Monument. Which for those of you who don't remember, it's don't fire till you see the whites of their eyes. Which actually was really kind of a surreal moment because we were standing there and Bunker Hill is not a very big hill and you can kind of see the harbor and stuff. And we'd been walking around. They have a giant monument there now. We've been walking around and like just kind of seeing everything. And at some point I kind of stopped our little group, my girlfriend and our cousin. And I was like, Just look around. Look at the people around you and try to see the whites of their eyes. Like, how close do they have to be before you can see the white in the corners of their eyes? And it's like, they have to be close, like really, really uncomfortably close before you can actually see that. And like, and you can see the harbor off in the distance where the British ships had been docked and were bombarding Bunker Hill. And you could see, and just trying to imagine like being there, they dung out a bunch of like trenches and stuff, built a quote earthen fort that they are. So they're just hunkering down as the battleships are bombarding their position. As 2,000 British troops are marching up this little hill towards them, and they're just sitting there waiting, knowing that they don't have 2,000 bullets.
Kind of reminds me of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, where the rider's coming and coming and coming and coming.
Just
sitting there waiting.
Just sitting there waiting. And then finally... And
that's got to do wonders for your psyche.
And then when they finally get there, it's like just because you know you have fewer bullets than troops, you got to do as much damage as you can. It's your only hope. So you just stood there and waited until they were so close, like a dozen feet from you, guns like loaded and firing, and they popped up over the mountain and started shooting. And
you know what they needed? They needed some elves with some sick bow and arrow skills.
Yeah, right. Yeah. See, the crazy, and it's funny because I was just like, it was really, I don't know, it was really impactful just kind of standing there trying to imagine it. And then, and we went across the street to this museum memorial thing that they have across the street. And they had a painting of the scene at the top of Bunker Hill. And there's a guy who's like falling down, like he's being shot, and his jacket is torn back, and he's got on a shirt and painted on his shirt. It says "Live Free or Die." And he's just like, yeah, exactly. I was like, chills.
But then did someone spray paint in the word "hard"?
Right. But it was pretty impactful. There was a lot of stuff like that where you just like, oh, this is really cool. I can get into this. And also at the same time, we had the Olympics going on, which was great. Being able to watch Usain Bolt
in almost real time.
Be a monster. Yeah.
I guess pretty fast.
Yeah. Yeah, he's pretty fast, I'd say. Did you see the qualifying 200-meter dash for him?
Where he walked the last 50 meters?
Yeah, but the Canadian trying just all out as hard as he could, trying to get him in the last couple of steps so that he could beat his own bolt once.
It sounds like that was actually a pretty dumb move on his part, other than he would have been able to say he beat him. But because they were like, it totally hoses him for the next race.
Oh, yeah.
Because he builds up too much lactic acid and whatever.
Oh,
like, he's like, he already had it. He didn't have to do that. But
it was a horrible idea, except that he would have been able to say he had beat Usain Bolt once, there's a part of me that's like, if I could beat Usain Bolt in a race, even if it's a qualifying race and everybody knows he's not trying as hard as he can, but for the rest of you, you're not going to get gold.
Right.
You might as well. It's almost a bigger achievement. And the best part was Usain Bolt, like, seeing him out of the corner of his eye in the last couple of steps. And they have some great shots where they're tracking along with Bolt and the Canadians coming up right up to him. Usain Bolt looks over his shoulder. And, like, as he crosses the finish line, like, an inch before the Canadian, he just wags his finger at him like, no, you don't. It's great. It was great. I don't know. I loved it.
Yeah. He made sure it wasn't even close in the final.
I know.
That was ridiculous.
And he was upset at the end of it because, as he described it,
he did not set a world record.
Yeah. Well, as he described it, it was the first time in his life that he had asked his body for more and his body said no. And you're like, oh, age. He's so old now. He can't. He's in decrepit. Decrepit, not decrepit. He's decrepit, old and broken. He's 4 days younger than me.
He's Google.
Feel really bad about me.
Exactly. Is he really?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. I know. So he had a birthday recently too.
Yeah, I think it was yesterday.
Okay.
But very cool.
Wow. How does that make you feel? That always, like, I try not to think about it too much.
Well, he's a freak of nature that nobody's ever been as fast as or ever will be. So it's easier to deal with. Like, I know he's the same age as me, but it's not like, well, if I tried it harder.
He's 30?
Yep.
Ugh, that's ridiculous.
I know.
Okay.
Just knowing that it's not like I could have tried harder and been in his league helps me deal with the fact that he's a multi-millionaire, fastest man on earth.
He's Yeah, I was actually reading some, or listening, maybe listening. I think I've done more listening than reading lately. But anyways, they were saying that a lot of the athletes now are a lot older than they used to be in the past. And, you know, there's comments about him like, oh, he's so old. And Michael Phelps, oh, he's so old. And one of the comments was, we finally figured out a way to, it's going to sound really weird, for athletes to monetize their skill so that they can continue to be athletes longer. As opposed to, it used to be like, well, I'm out of college, I have to get a job, and you just can't train like you used to, and so therefore you're not as good of an athlete, and you drop off the map just like normal. But now, like, it's a legitimate career, which is pretty crazy that that's the privileged point that we're in now. And that's just kind of like, I don't know, you don't think about the sports arena, but it's just like a lot of the tech companies, and this is me attempting to bring it back,
I appreciate
where it's
that.
Like, no, if you can figure out how to monetize, you can hang around for a long time and do some really cool, amazing things. And they're doing it physically right now. And that's pretty cool. Yeah. I like it.
Which, by the way, happens to be what we're talking about this week, like we talk about every week, which is the technology and the continuing corporate opera, not sports. Not birthdays, not Boston, but the soap opera of corporations' dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and of course, the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James has got a short disclosure he's got to throw our way.
You know, it is a little bit like we're talking history, if you think about it. It's just
just short history.
Really short history. Yeah, anyways, I founded and work for HPI. However, I do not represent HPI or any of Hewlett-Packard Inc.'s opinions. I also own part of Twitter, Etsy, and Lending Club, which continues to have troubles.
Yeah, it happens.
Just yesterday, so apparently I learned this, that Lending Club, like, they publish all of the data of their borrowers online in, like, Excel format. It's all, they leave off the name or whatever, but it's like, you can go onto their website. I don't know how to do this, but you can go on their website and download all their data. It's part of their open and transparency nature of it. And so it's funny. There was this guy who, he was like, oh, this is kind of cool. I'd be interested to do it. And so he grabbed the data for his particular loans, and he noticed this one person lived in the same area, happened to have the same job, and made very similar incomes. And I was like, that's interesting. And he posited, he doesn't know for sure, but he was like, I'm pretty sure this is the same guy. And what was interesting, he said they had different interest rates, but they were both active at the same time. Because what caught his attention was in one of the earnings calls, they said that multiple borrowers, like 40% of their borrowers, go back for a second loan. And they made it sound like you pay off your loan and then you get a second one. And he was like, no, this guy has two loans at the same time. He's going back, but it's a little different. And what's super interesting too is he had done some data research and found 32 loans where he was like, these ones are really weird. They're different than all the others. Where through his, he had this idea of saying, maybe there are people who are the same person getting out different loan amounts for different interest rates. Could he identify who those are and then just do the one with the higher interest rate?
Right.
And kind of double down on it because somewhere the credit thing. So, and it was kind of his idea was to have a company that could help filter that out and kind of be a layer on top of it. But in that process, he found 32 loans that were really weird. Like he was like, that was four people in the span of like 8 days. And he goes, and I think it's just four borrowers because they each had very similar information. He was like, but each time just one thing was changed and that was it. It was like, and when you put them all together, you went, oh yeah, totally the same person. And they were all for similar types of loan reasons. He was like, these four people took out 32 loans for almost $1 million over an 8-day time period. And he was like posing to be different people. And this was like in December that he saw this. And it was earlier this year. So after that had happened, when I actually bought Lending Club because the CEO was ousted for doing insider lending stuff. And it turned out those were the loans where that happened. And this guy, because I said, yeah, there were 32 irregular loans. And it was the ones where he saw them and was like, yeah, there's something funky about these. I don't understand them. And it had flagged them. And he wasn't the one who whistle blew on them because he didn't know what he was looking at. Right. But he was like, yeah, it was you could see it, that something was weird about it.
That's crazy.
So anyway, so I own that.
That's awesome. That's very cool. I still own Skull Candy, I think. I'm not sure I do. At this point, I'm not exactly sure what's going on there.
Are you afraid to open the app just to find
pretty
out?
Pretty much, yeah.
I'm just going to let this
it's
one ride.
It's $5.
What you don't want is some like auto pop-up where it's like yes or no. Like, no, quit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Turn off the internet.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So, real quick, we got a comment this week on one of our videos. It's Mutation 666 is the name. And essentially he was giving us some suggestions. Just thought I'd share some of them.
I always like suggestions.
Number one, he thinks you need a new webcam. Just put it out there. Or me. I don't know. He didn't really say. I'm going to go with my lighting because in my new place, it's kind of messed up. So
yeah. You got to get them Philip Hughes, man.
Oh, I know. Actually, I'm going to rotate my desk. I think that'll make a difference.
Yeah, probably.
But I do need something over the desk. I'm feeling that. He also suggests we do a little more editing, which thanks, Mutation 666.
Yeah.
and likes our stuff. He says, keep it going. So there you go.
Nice. I appreciate that.
He's got a couple other like technical things in there. But
I'm going to say.
I just wanted to share.
We recognize the value of editing. It's not that we don't think we need it. It's that we don't have time for it. and there's not a great, as we haven't monetized this yet, it's hard. But yeah, I get it. We appreciate the feedback every time. Yeah, if you want to give us feedback, feel free to. You can feedback me at Matthew D. Furlow on Twitter, or check out my photos from Boston on Instagram. My feed handle thing is nextwiggin4, nextwiggin, and the number 4.
James Furlow on twitter.com, on Instagram. I started using the stories thing a little bit.
Yeah,
it's okay.
It's all right.
Today,
don't hate it.
I took a picture of a sign that said, please pick up your dog poop. I don't think I said poop. I probably said like
excrement.
Excrement, refuse,
livens,
droppings, whatever. I could probably look at my picture and find out. And literally right under the sign, pile of dog poop.
That's pretty funny.
Like, that's perfect.
So, a little bit of self disobedience
totally
right there.
Instagram worthy, but I was like, it's stories worthy.
Gotcha. Felt like. Yeah.
So, anyways,
I have a hard time deciding if it doesn't raise to the level of a picture. I don't know. This tells you how old I am. I'm like,
see, I automatically share my Instagram photos to Facebook.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, if I don't want it on Facebook, it's going to a story, which I didn't really want that one on Facebook. Whereas the super cute picture I took of my daughter in a tree, I was like, that's going everywhere.
That's interesting because I do make that differentiation. I do sometimes put stuff just on Instagram and not on the Facebook. Huh.
I 99% of the time I'm doing both.
Fascinating.
Which now that I have stories, it will probably be 100% of the time.
But you know where we'll put 100% of our effort into, James? Furloughbros.com. Everything we're going to talk about today, all the articles, clicks, links, videos, audio clips, anything like that, you can go to furloughbros.com. It's there. Check it out. It's awesome. Yeah, we like it. But
cool.
That's our deal.
You know what we don't like?
What?
Dumb things to do with your smartphone. I saw this fun article. It's 11 of them, to be specific. Dumb things that you do with your smartphone.
Oh, I hope I don't do them.
Just want to make sure. Shutting down all the apps running in the background. Apparently, you're not supposed to do that. Or you don't have to do that.
I know
I feel
people
good when I do it, though.
I know people that like are flabbergasted when they see that my phone has like 50 apps open, and they're like, "How does your phone run normally?" And I was like, you do realize that that little icon that you're flipping up and quote unquote deleting, all it's doing is literally deleting that picture that's saved as a picture in your phone, in your RAM, that you're deleting when you swipe up.
So what's
up.
The point of that then?
What it
if
does
that's really two, all that it is.
It does two things. Number one, it forces a call to be made that all apps make when they first get open. And it's, I think it's app will startup. Like it restarts you. There's a loop that all apps are on that they get frozen. And okay. Depending on what state they get frozen in, they'll stop. And you're basically restarting the loop, but you're not clearing RAM. So if the app is acting weird, you can do that, and sometimes it'll reset the loop, and we'll reset the logic. But mostly, it's there to make you feel good.
Huh.
Honestly,
well, that's working.
Yeah, you know.
Okay, all right, fair enough. Next one: drain the battery to zero as soon as you get your phone.
You're not supposed like to do that.
Like the idea is that swimming within an hour of eating means you'll cramp up and die. Sitting too close to the TV will ruin your eyesight, or 9/11 wasn't an inside job. We'll probably have this myth with us forever. It's like, wait. I don't know how to take this now. But yeah, so apparently back when there were older nickel cadmium or nickel metal hydride batteries, those were the ones that would forget a charge, and so you constantly wanted to... Or not constantly, but regularly take it to zero and all the way up, but then not all the time. But now with lithium ion, it's totally fine.
Yeah.
So stop doing that. I love this one. Buying a screen protector. I don't get screen protectors. You don't have one on your phone, right?
Heck no, tech now.
Yeah, they're like, it's garbage. They're like, the glass is so strong now that it's actually, you will get less scratches because the stupid... little screen protector scratches really easily.
Yeah, it'd be like putting a scratch detector on your diamond ring. Why would you do that?
Which, by the way, he said that's pretty much the only thing you shouldn't put in your pocket with your phone.
Yeah.
But outside of that, you're good to go.
Sapphire and diamonds are at this point pretty much the only thing that it can scratch a screen. Outside of that, obviously they can be brittle, but you know, brittle. Your screen protector is not going to help save it from a blow to its face. It's only there to protect it from scratches.
Makes sense. Never use a third party charger. I don't know. You weren't supposed to not do that.
Well, there was a while there where like the iPhone would yell at you for using a third party charger.
Oh,
and then because they wanted to make sure that it was a certified one so that it wouldn't damage the iPhone because it wasn't delivering too much power or whatever. And then they finally just built the circuitry into the iPhone that's like, just check if it's, you know, going to work or not. And then it will yell at you if it's getting a dangerous charge. And it'll tell you, like, we're not charging with this. Unplug the wire. And but yeah, those like cheap ones, if it doesn't do anything wrong, you're fine.
How about this one? Being on an upgrade plan. Apparently, they say that's a dumb thing to do. Yeah. Best bet, financially speaking, buy the phone outright.
Yes!
And even if you buy a new one every year and resell the old one, they're like, it's still cheaper to do that than to do the upgrade program.
Yep.
But the upgrade program is so convenient.
I know. And it gets you on that monthly plan so you can be financed for the rest of your life, which is pretty nice.
Yeah.
No, for everybody else, not you.
Cash up front.
But... yeah, no, that's... I mean, honestly, anybody who, like, thinks, oh, I'll finance...
What if your phone gets broken or something? Then what do you do?
AppleCare Plus.
Do you get that, too?
Yeah, well I do. Yeah, obviously. Okay.
All right. All right.
But I'm an idiot.
Yeah. Okay, got it. Thinking that a massive battery alone will give you days without a charge. I thought this was actually interesting. So battery improvements are pretty slow.
Right.
And so a lot of times you'll read about the sizes of the battery and go, oh, it's got a bigger number, so therefore it must be better. It's like, well, not necessarily. The biggest thing actually that improves battery life is software optimization.
Right.
And so, which I don't know how you test for that, but it's like, just don't blindly choose biggest battery.
So this is related. I didn't think it deserved an entire article because it's lab tests, but MIT claims they had a huge breakthrough that they announced earlier this week that they can double the capacity of a lithium ion battery. And they think that it would be commercializable by the end of 2017, which is nuts, if that's true.
Wow.
Because a lot of times, like, you'll get these improvements and, like, we can improve the battery by 10%, but it requires, like, a completely new way of manufacturing the battery. So you'll have to spend $1 billion on this new factory and get a small, like, it's not a big enough improvement.
Yeah.
Whereas a doubling is a big enough improvement to justify a $1 billion factory. So hopefully that's true, but.
Okay. The other thing is thinking how many megapixels on your phone camera has matters.
Yeah. Oh,
I destroyed that sentence, but you know what I mean.
I gotcha.
So he's saying, honestly, as long as you have at least 12 megapixels, you're probably pretty good.
Well, I kind of got into the megapixel, like, oh, megapixels matter a lot, until I realized that DSLR is oftentimes, like, not your, like, super modern ones, but ones that are, like, even 5 years old, but they were like the highest end cameras at the time. And 5 years ago, they were already selling 12 megapixel phone cameras, but the DSLRs had 8 megapixel lenses on them, but it was all about the like the actual megapixel size and like the lens type and stuff. There's so much that goes into a good picture other than just the number of pixels. And 12 megapixels is kind of like your bar for high resolution photos at this point, but
I like this one. You're avoiding Android phones because they're full of malware.
Mm.
Like, no, you're fine.
It's true. I mean, it's true-ish.
I agree.
There's more. You can open yourself up to a lot more with Android, but it's not nearly as bad as everybody makes it sound.
And they're like, there are certain benefits, like customizations that outweigh it. Having a dark background or reading when text on black saves your battery.
Who thinks that?
I don't know. They had to come up with an article, okay?
Yeah.
Just leave them alone. And then I thought this was interesting. Turning off Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, or location services to save your battery. It's like, just don't use those apps and those different features aren't used. To which I was like, yeah.
Yeah, but that's not true.
That stops me from accidentally using it. And what about someone like me where I always have reminders set based on location?
I was going to say, the thing is, like, unless you're somebody who uses apps that are constantly, like, because if you can have apps that use location services while you're using the app. But there's also apps like, what's it called? A great example is like setting up a perimeter, a reminder that works on a perimeter. Every time I get to work, remind me to turn on the lights. I don't know. Whatever, like that constantly runs in the background. And I have location services constantly running. If I flip that switch to turn off location services, then all of those processes that are constantly running, like it has a one thread that's doing location services that's pushing updates to all of the apps that are asking for it. So it's not like, you know, doing it, but like you have to turn it off in order to for it to not be doing that. That's, I get what they're saying, but that's, especially on the iPhone, that's just not true.
Seems like a technicality. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. Not charging your phone overnight to avoid overcharging it. We talked about that last week or 2 weeks ago, where the phones are now good enough that they figured out how to do it, how to avoid that. And then finally, thinking that freezing your phone will help your battery. Just like, just don't do that. It's not good for your phone.
Seems like a real bad idea.
So there you go. You're welcome.
Interesting. That's fascinating. There was something for everybody there, or not. I don't know. do you ever go to the McDonald's?
Yeah, regularly. Yeah. I just yesterday got a free medium fries because I went to a baseball game.
Nice.
So I visited, and I may have picked up some of the food while there.
They're doing Gilroy garlic fries in California right now. I don't know if they're doing it everywhere. Yeah. I haven't gotten them yet. I'm like, I gotta do it. I just gotta do it. Maybe after my marathon next week. I'm gonna be so obnoxious. Now that I'm coming up to it, I'm going to be like, man, this reminds me of my marathon all the time. have you introduced your daughter to the wonderful world of Happy Meals?
Yeah, she loves fries just as much as her dog.
Who doesn't? Whether they're good for you or bad for you, they're delicious. So McDonald's has decided that, kind of in honor of the Olympics and healthy living and just sort of as a, you know, trying to not have themselves branded as a horrible place, they're going to give out toys that are health trackers. So really? Little wristbound health trackers. Yeah. And for the next 4 weeks, you can get them where you strap them onto your wrist and they'll have like little LED indicators that will tell you when you're doing activity, which totally makes sense because it kind of gamifies the whole thing for kids, which is kind of cool and encourages them to get out and burn off those calories that they just ate. And it seems like a cool little – oh, wait, sorry, let me correct that. No, they're not giving those out anymore because they cause rashes.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, 2 days Oops. Later, it was like, yeah. So they're like, we'll figure something else out about that. Yeah, they McDonald's Happy Meal might be beloved for including their toys, but the food inside is just as unhealthy as most menus, Golden Arch, blah, 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 blah.
That's tough.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, reports of possible skin irritations prompted the chain to end the promotion early. 2 days later, yeah. Instead of handing out the pedometers until the international games ceased for their 4 week run, McDonald's will hand out a substitute toy while they investigate potential dermal abrasions.
Yeah. Wow.
Franchise gave no further details. Bummer.
Oops.
Yep.
I applied the efforts to get all techie and see the current trend and get kids on it, but oops.
Yep. Just so close.
That hurts.
So McDonald's. It's funny because it's like, it's hilarious too. Cause you're like, McDonald's is kind of, I mean, come on, supersize me. Like the whole deal is we make really yummy, but unhealthy food. Your burgers don't taste like anything anybody's ever eaten in all of human history, but they're delicious. So I'm okay with it. But they really don't like, it's funny because I've heard the question asked, why don't they just embrace the, look, we make delicious food that's bad for you. Just come here when you're in the mood for that, like a donut store or whatever. But they really try to like push this whole, no, we're not super bad for you. You can have your kids eat here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I get it. They see the trends.
Yeah.
And your price argument only goes so far.
Yeah. I think it's got a bit of the feel of like they just don't want to be, if they can do anything to sort of like edge away from being that place, just do something, anything to not be the Supersize Me corporation, you know?
I wonder what the lead time is for their Happy Meals. You know, it's like, did they come up with that 2 weeks ago and come up with a prototype and roll it out to the world? Or is this something that they've been working on for 2 years? Like you think about like another company's product life cycle. Example, HP, printers are in development for 3 years. Cartridges are in development for 5 years. Like, which I fully recognize are a little bit more complicated than a kid's health tracker.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? It's in development for a while.
I'll bet you would find that they have a surprisingly long lead time on all of this stuff.
Simply, I mean, there's got to be a team, right? Well, that's their job.
Oh yeah,
Happy Meal toys.
Well, it's like there's an entire planning team for making sure that you're like lining up your different cross promotional things. That you got your Marvel toys in time for Avengers and everything, and. You know, I got to believe that
Yeah, I guess that's true. They're working with all those partnerships and figuring out revenue splits and right. whatever.
Because this was a big Olympics thing. So it's not like you can't just – you got to work with NBC on that. You've known for 4 years that it was coming. Like, I wouldn't be surprised at all if you'd find that these are like – if every toy is a year in the making at least. I would be very surprised, especially just from like a tooling up to manufacture whatever they're building and – building up supply, like delivering it to every McDonald's in whatever area they're doing. And you know, each region has their own team that does Happy Meal stuff. Mm-hmm. I'll bet that the Happy Meal toy would be an impressive company in and of itself if it wasn't part of McDonald's.
Yeah, probably a huge operation. Yeah, you're probably right. I was there recently and I saw their soda machine thing for the drive-thru.
Oh, yeah, they're awesome.
Dude, it's ridiculous. It actually has like a little arm that grabs the cup, puts it in, moves it over, does the ice automatically, fills up it with the drink automatically, and then all I gotta do is put the lid on.
And the greatest part about it is you can say, hey, can I get light ice on that? And they have a button for light ice, and it puts light ice in it. Like, it's great. It's like, that automation is so fantastic. And the best part about it is, like, they found that it was cheaper and easier for really busy locations to feed into a centralized call station. So, like, if you're going to a really busy McDonald's, they have, you're not talking to somebody in the restaurant. You're talking to somebody, you know, in the next state over, who's part of a giant call center where they're all very highly trained for that specific job. And then they type that all into the menu that gets associated with a picture of your car that gets pushed to the restaurant. The restaurant just makes it the soda machine makes the soda at the right time for the right car. It's crazy how automated the drive-through is at the McDaniels. It's good stuff. I like it.
That's the impressive part about their company.
Oh yeah,
do all that,
and it's inevitable that they're, because they've already done so much automation on that front. Like, the idea that they aren't going to someday build a robotic burger flipper, fry maker, that this whole thing's not just going to be
experimenting with genetically created foods. Like, what if we didn't grow the cows or the potatoes, you know, or something? I just wonder.
3D printed potato fries.
Think about it. You know, somewhere someone's doing some sort of experiments, and they're trying to figure out if they can get away with it socially.
Right. Exactly. Well, then I know with the whole robotic automated fry cook thing, their problem isn't a technological one. It's a price point one. They sit there and go, there's a certain cost of labor that once we cross that, it makes sense to the ROI on a robotic fry cooker becomes advantageous enough where we could pay it off in 5 years and it'll have a 10-year lifespan and we'll make X amount of money. But it only makes sense once you get to this cost of labor. Yeah. And that's McDonald's argument against, well, not against necessarily, but their warning about raising the minimum wage too much is that specifically, once you get to a certain level, we just won't do that.
McDonald's. Yeah, they're kind of a, I don't know. We talked about this before, I guess. They're an example to me of a company that blurs the line between being a tech company and a fast food company.
Yeah.
Because on some degree, they're probably one of the biggest robotics and automation companies in the world, if you think about it in that term.
Yeah, automated manufacturing at the scale that they do it. Transportation.
It's kind of crazy.
And, transportation and what's the word? Just do everything. It's nuts. They're a crazy company. They're a really cool company from that perspective.
That makes food that's not great for you.
Yeah. Delicious.
Time to change that.
But not particularly healthy. Interesting stuff. Good stuff. Mm-hmm. So speaking of a company that you don't normally think of as a tech company, that's not true. That's the exact opposite of true. Speaking of a tech company, you think of it as a tech company, Uber made an announcement this week that next month, one of their self-driving cars will pick up its first fare.
Dang.
Yeah. So the idea is
self-driving cars is a thing.
Yeah. So we've known for a couple of months now that Uber's been testing out self-driving cars in Detroit.
Is it in Oregon?
I said, no, I think it's Detroit. No, that can't be right.
Detroit? Pittsburgh.
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 Pittsburgh. It's Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh. It's Pittsburgh.
Oh, that's where their offices are.
Yeah. What movie is that from? Come on, man.
I know.
And there we go.
What? The O'Neaters.
Yeah. Doing that thing you do. So it's going to pick up its first customer. The idea is it sort of works
Is there a driver in the car?
Yes.
Okay.
So this is the deal. It's not legal for them to actually have a driverless car. It has to have a driver in the automated car. But the driver hopefully won't be driving very much. So the deal is, it's going to be it's going to be even worse than normal, because not only do they have the driver, who their job is to sit there and make sure the car doesn't kill anybody, most importantly, the person in the back, there's also going to be another person with a laptop and a notebook in the passenger seat taking notes on what the driver in the car is doing. Awkward. So you'll have more drivers than normal in your driverless car.
Perfect.
But yeah, so we've known for a couple of months they've been testing these out in Pittsburgh. They're getting ready to pick up their first fare to incentivize people. You'll actually get the fare for free. It won't cost you nothing to take a ride in one of these incredibly dangerous, inhumane vehicles.
I love it. They're just doing testing, so like, I might as well drive people around while we're doing it.
Exactly.
I like it.
Yeah, if it's safe enough to throw a driver in it, it's got to be safe enough to throw a passenger in it. And it's great. Yeah. It's definitely a PR stunt, because they are even pretty candid about the fact that there are bridges in Pittsburgh that the cars can't navigate themselves. Like, they know that that the driver has to take over from time to time. But overall, it's pretty cool. Like, this is the direction that they are going. And they're going to get there.
There's a part of me that's like, I always get torn. Like, on one hand, awesome, it's gonna push others to get better. On the other hand, I'm like, we're splitting up our forces. I think of Beauty and the Beast.
You know what? You've intrigued me. I really want to know where you're going with this.
Arguably, one of the best movies of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe not even arguably. Maybe it just is. But one of the reasons why it was so great was Disney had the all-star team. They had all the best working on the same movie at the same time. By the way, that was very similar to Pixar when they did Toy Story and a bunch of their other ones until
Nemo.
Four in, where then they split it up into two groups. But all that to say, they had everyone working on the same project at the same time, and it produced amazing results. And there's a part of me that's like, man, I kind of wish that was happening with the driver cars or driverless cars, because it would be amazing to have all of these different super smart guys working on the same problem. But I also get the nice part about competition and splitting people up.
Yeah. But I don't know.
For things like sports teams where the rules are pretty obvious.
Yeah.
And straightforward, and everyone knows how to play. Yeah, I'm in. But this is kind of like, we're forging new ground. We're figuring out how to do this. Like, teamwork, guys.
Where I hope they get together is pushing legislation.
Ooh.
Because I think that one's going to take a really coordinated effort to kind of get people over that hill. I had a really fascinating conversation just today, as a matter of fact, about a friend of mine was watching a car show on Netflix. Not Top Gear. I feel like I
should know.
On Netflix. Top 7 car shows on Netflix. Is it Overhauling? No.
No.
Street Customs? No.
Maybe.
American Muscle Car? Top Gear? Ooh. Knight Rider? Miami Vice? I feel like we're completely, I don't remember.
Knight Rider?
Called. Yeah.
I get it. Miami Vice is a little bit of a stretch there.
Yeah, right. This is whatever. So the point is, it's kind of a Top Gear-esque show. Okay. But they did a competition between the Tesla and the new Dodge Spitfire, which is the 700 horsepower charger. It's a beast of a car.
Sounds like a beast.
And they did a quarter mile in it, but the Tesla beat it. Yes.
Yes. Because we all drive a quarter mile.
I'm going to say electric cars for the win. But they also did a big, big expose on the automated driving features of the Tesla. And we were talking about it. And, like, he's a big car guy. Like, he watches car shows on Netflix. He likes cars. He likes driving. Yeah, that's a big deal for him. And he was talking about it. And he was really fascinated by the idea of people how many people don't actually like driving. That they just stopped driving if it was in their power. And he was like, it's crazy to him because he's a big car guy. And just how many bad drivers there are on the road. He's like, I don't know, maybe it makes sense to get all this like automated car driving stuff going. And like, you know, and Jen just relegates driving to tracks where you can like open up the cars and it's regulated for that. And you can actually have fun. I guess because there's a lot of parts of driving that aren't that much fun. And I was like, and he gave an example of how he was on the BART train in the Bay Area Rapid Transit. He was on one of the trains to go to jury duty. It was like, you know, it was actually really nice because it was like you get on the train takes you there. It's like three blocks, you're there, and it goes, I can kind of get used to that idea of not having to think about driving at all. I was like, yeah, and it gets even better because like you don't even have that three block walk with your automated cars. Like it'll drop you off at the steps of wherever you're going, you'll go do your thing for the day and it'll park itself. And then when it's time to go, you just hit the button. It's time to go. Car will swing back around and pick you up and you just hop in your car and drive off and you're good for the day. And he was like, yeah, seriously, that's like a great idea because no matter how much you like driving, nobody likes parking. I was like, exactly. And then I went a step further and was like, and just imagine, what if instead of like park my car button, you just flip it into Uber mode and it goes and makes money for you while you're doing your thing at jury duty for the day. And he was like, oh my gosh, like it just blew his mind. Like that's such a good idea. And I was like, yeah, it's kind of where everybody wants to go. Like that's the point of this. And yeah, I see Uber's strategy here being a really good one, especially because I think they're going to work out with their whole building their own cars is they want to have a fleet of cars because they think that there's a lot of money there. And I think they're right. But if they can set up an ecosystem where your self-driving car, whether you're Ford or Google or Tesla or whatever, can join their fleet while you're not there, that'd be pretty cool.
And did you see that Ford actually announced that by 2021, they're going to have an autonomous car without a steering wheel or pedals, and they're going to set up an Uber type of thing as well?
Right. That's really happening. That's not Google doing it. That's not, like, when Google does it,
we'll
you get
see,
really...
I'm a little dubious of it. I mean, I get the autonomous car thing, but to have them say, and we're going to set up our own Uber thing.
Well, they signed a huge deal with Lyft.
Oh, I know, but we'll see.
I see what you're saying, but I guess what my point is, like, from a manufacturing, like, from a tech perspective, the fact that Google has made autonomous cars isn't shocking. From a tech perspective, the fact that Uber is figuring out how to set up this, like, you know, autonomous car ride sharing isn't shocking. What's shocking to me is when, like, an actual car manufacturer goes into full-scale manufacturing of cars without driver wheels or pedals. This isn't what Tesla's doing, which is like a halfway there. No, Ford's just going full in. We're making full-on autonomous cars. Autonomous driving, driverless cars, not drivers sitting in the car seat ready to take over. No, you can't drive this, driverless cars, which is to
that
me.
That must mean they feel pretty good about the legislation. You know,
you got this
piece as well.
Legislative.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh my gosh. By the way, did you see the XKCD cartoon?
I did. I did.
A couple previous ones where it was saying, like, we're doing all our comparisons wrong, comparing driverless cars to humans. Like, actually, we need to compare them to horses.
Right. The bar is higher.
If you got drunk on your horse and fell asleep, it would just walk home. And if you tried to ride a horse into a tree, the horse could be like, no.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, that's what we should be judging against in driverless cars. That's so awesome.
I liked how I think the best part is the description at the end. This car's got 200 horses under the hood and 3.5 in the computer.
Ooh. Ooh. Oh my gosh.
Yeah,
we're headed there.
It's pretty, and there's definitely a truth there. Like, it's, you know, it comes back to the whole idea of for autonomous cars to take over, the bar shouldn't be they're perfect. The bar should be they're better. And How do you eat? And I think we're really close, if not already there, in many, many, many different circumstances. So how do we get that sweet, sweet self-driving car business going on? I really like it. But Uber, their bout of self-driving carness wasn't done for the week. They announced that they're teaming up with Volvo to actually do this, you know, as they're gearing up to do to buy a fleet of self-driving cars. Well, who's going to build it for them? Turns out Volvo is the go-to option on this. And Volvo's they're a big competitor with Tesla on this type of technology. People who criticize Tesla's technology is not that cool will usually point out companies like Volvo as a perfect example of they've got self-braking. They have lane following. They have, you know, they have the ability to get onto a freeway, set autopilot, take your hands off the wheels, and it'll just do its thing for you. Like, they're pretty sophisticated in that way already. Did you ever see that video? This is years ago. Volvo was doing a demonstration of their automatic braking mechanism.
Uh-huh.
And they had a semi truck parked in front of bleachers where they had like all of their executives like sitting so that they could see this. And they remote controlled this car and drove it at like 70 miles per hour, just got it up to speed and as fast as they could get it into this, to the rear end of this semi so that it could show it stopping automatically in time and it just plows into it and shoots underneath it. I mean, just that doesn't break at all.
Oops.
Yeah, it's really bad. oh geez. But
thanks.
I know, it's great. Person would have been dead. But their technology has gotten better since then. So Uber's teaming up with them.
It's hard to get worse.
Exactly. Literally. This is going to be a huge deal, it looks like. And if not the only, it's the biggest partner that they're going to have for now. But Uber also wanted to, you know, they're not going to rely on the car companies to do all their automation for them. They bought a company that we actually talked about a couple of months ago called Otto. It was a startup they announced they were getting up and going, and their whole deal was they're a bunch of former Google employees who had been working with the automated car project, and they wanted to build retrofits for semis. And we talked about it at the time, the whole idea was, you know, they wanted to be able to get at least these semis to be able to drive themselves on freeways so that people would only have to take over the last mile and you could retrofit it to currently existing technology.
You could hold a lot more sensors.
Exactly. Yeah. So it seemed like a pretty good direction, and it turns out like Uber just bought them.
Agreed.
So they wanted all that brain power, and that's where they're going, and it's pretty cool.
Oh, man.
And the last piece of this puzzle, though, I think is interesting, mostly because I was just there and used Uber a lot. But Massachusetts has decided that they're preparing for the ever-growing domination of Uber. And they're going to – they announced a new tax. Yeah, I want to – this is really kind of an interesting thing. State and city governments have been trying to protect the taxi industry from ride-sharing services for a while. Massachusetts is taking an unusual route. Governor recently enacted a law that will charge drivers charge ride-sharing services a 20-cent fee for subsidizing transportation infrastructure, 5 cents of which will go to the taxi industry.
What?
Yes. Every Lyft and Uber you hail will directly fund the taxis they're competing against.
That's the dumbest thing ever.
I know. Officials still have to hash out the finer details, such as how they'll collect the fee and spend it, but the legislation prevents companies from tacking it onto your fare, which is the dumbest. Like, so they can't, I guess what it means is they legally can't say, you know, we've, cause they're like, if you look at how you're, if they look at how they struck like your bill for an Uber, they've got distance, they've got time, and then they've got a flat fee that they add all, and that's your cost. So if there's a lot of traffic, but you don't go very far, like just down the Las Vegas Strip, it's still really expensive.
Oh, okay. I understand.
And, but that like fee is like a fixed fee. I guess they're not allowed to like put in another explicit, oh, and this 20 cents fee is paying for the taxis that you're not using. but it's like, this is, I don't want to get political, but the idea here is that the problem that they're running into is that the taxis are still pretty powerful in these areas, especially like in Boston and stuff. There's a lot of votes there. So they're just paying off the taxi companies at the cost of the ride sharing companies, because like they want to prevent stuff like picking up at airports or convention centers. They want to, well, they, Boston doesn't, Boston taxis don't, operators association would prefer an outright ban on any ride sharing firm that doesn't follow the same rules as taxis do, which, you know, is kind of a, it's their way of trying to prevent the, taxi.
So wait, so now they can.
So they're
pick
so
up
no.
at those other plate. Okay.
So the idea here is that there were no regulations.
Wow, this is like a classic tie both hands behind your back and we're still going to beat you situation.
Pretty much. They're like, so yeah. So what happens is obviously ride sharing started out a couple of years ago with no regulations. And then over the last couple of years, regulations have been put on them. Like there are huge stipulations about where you can pick up riders at the airport, who can, like Lyft can't pick up at Boston Logan International. Uber has to pick them up in a particular location because Uber has negotiated a contract with them. And the Boston Taxi Operators Association wants to put even more restrictions on ride sharing and more fees and more stuff like that to kind of level the playing field. So this is basically Uber's way of saying, fine, we'll pay you 20 cents or 5 cents a ride to buy off the union. Wow. To give them time.
Well, way to go, Charlie Baker, for messing that up.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
He's the governor, in case you didn't know.
I appreciate that. You're throwing that out there. Yeah, I don't know. Big week for Uber. Big week for self-driving cars.
Yeah, seriously, man. Oh, dude. The future.
I know. It's future's happening, man.
Coming fast.
Yes, it is.
It's and accelerating.
It's, and it's coming on its own. Nobody's in the driver's seat.
Okay, I gotta get this going. Oh. Oh, man, that's awesome. Okay, cool. Very, very cool. Less cool, but I came to a revelation.
Yeah.
This week.
The Chiefs are going to win it all. Okay.
Because I think like I'm going to say it, and I'm hoping that I blow your mind. That's my hope.
All right.
So expectations, there they are.
Just they're set. Lines. Perfect.
All right. So and this was really where I think it is, and it's two articles, but it's really just one. So we've talked about this before, but Twitter is getting into the live streaming game,
like, right?
Big time.
I think,
and they signed a deal with the NFL.
Twitter is really betting.
And one of the things that the point of this article was weird. The title was talking about Twitter is trying to bring their live streaming to Apple TV. And then it's like in a paragraph, it mentions it in the middle of the sentence or the story. Like, that was a really weird headline.
Well, the headline is designed to get you to click on it. It almost
it worked. Congratulations. Okay. Anyway, so they're doing this. And it was somewhere, and I can't even remember now because I was semi-disappointed by the article, but I came to this conclusion that, because I saw another article that was talking about, hey, it's time for me to cut the cable cord. Like, mm-hmm. Online services are awesome. We're doing it. And this is it. Live streaming is the future. That's what companies are going to do. Not DVRing and not on-demand television. So that was the whole thing with sports, right? It's like, oh, we all gotta watch it live. And the big problem with DVR and on-demand is you don't get as many commercials. Or when you do have a commercial, it seems like it's a really big deal. And but streaming online, companies and
live,
sports,
live streaming,
live streaming specifically, yes, with replays afterwards with commercials inserted, of course. But that's where we're headed. And it's a way for them to continue to command the commercials and to get the revenue dollars and get it distributed across all sorts of platforms. Am I right? It seems so obvious.
Yeah, I like it. I like that idea. I like that. See, the question I would have is, okay, now imagine this. Because, so, have you watched Stranger Things yet?
No, not yet. It's on the list.
So good. So Stranger Things Season 2 is going to be coming along. And anybody who's watched Stranger Things has liked it enough where they're kind of excited about the next season. I wonder if they could just call it like the debut of the next season is like, we're live streaming the first episode of Stranger Things. And like, obviously Netflix is kind of anti-commercial, but if like a Hulu were to do it, they could go in there and say like, oh, we're going to live stream the first opportunity to see this new episode of our cool TV show. We're going to live stream it, which is just, we're going to show it live, I guess. I mean, cause that's what TV is, right? That's the whole point
of
this.
That's all it is. Yeah.
That's really funny. I wonder, because it's from a practical perspective, it's literally the same thing. The only difference is what you call it. It's a live stream versus an on-demand stream.
It's totally where we're headed.
Versus, there's downloading, on-demand streaming, and then live streaming. I think you're right. I think what they've figured out, if anything, what they've figured out is that you can call it a live stream and people think about it different. It puts it in a different place in their head as opposed to, oh, it's just TV. This is how TV works.
Well, it's this thing where you can start paying. We'll see, into a pay-per-view type of thing where it's, oh, I want to watch this live stream. I'm going to pay for it. And maybe you get lifetime access. Maybe you don't. I don't know. Like, I'll be honest, some of the Olympic stuff, it would have been fun to watch, and I just haven't had time or whatever.
Right.
That's not what I meant to say. I have had some time, but I don't have cable, and I'm not about to go get it. But if NBC was willing to charge a reasonable rate, like, I probably honestly would pay $15, I might even go up to $30 to watch all of the Olympic stuff on my computer, whatever device I want. Just one time pass. Boom. Give me all the Olympic video. And live stream it. You know, whatever. But give me the previous ones if I wanted to as well. Totally would be willing to do that. And they could do those kind of one-off types of things. Just like the MLB pass. Because I think MLB is pretty good about doing that with their app. Other than they also have blackout stuff. So that's kind of dumb. But I don't know. It suddenly hit me where I went, this is where we're headed. It's this live streaming thing. And Twitter is obviously in a good position because it has the real-time conversation and they can do the ads. If Twitter was super smart too, they would figure out how to get their stuff embedded inside of like a Hulu or a Netflix or something. Cause that would be pretty interesting too. And set it up where it's like, here's the most popular ones, but then here's also my friends.
Right.
Are watching and talking about it with me. And I don't know. There's some cool possibilities. That's where it's headed. I don't know. All of a sudden it hit me.
To me, the only question is are they going to try to quote unquote live stream the first airing of stuff? Like, I know that's a big thing with the Game of Thrones when it comes out. And you got to be right there. You got to watch it. And they have the first airing of it on you can watch it quote unquote live on HBO, which is funny because
now on the HBO app, can you then replay it whenever?
So yeah, you can. This is what's so great is like it plays at 8 o'clock in the your local time is the first live streaming of it. And I don't live stream anything, quote unquote. I don't watch live TV. So I just watch it like on demand and, obviously we do the show like around 8 o'clock. So I got in the habit of, well, it turns out that 8 o'clock here is five, or I mean, 8 o'clock on the East Coast is 5 o'clock here, and it becomes available for on demand as soon as it airs on the East Coast. So all of my friends would wait till 8 o'clock to watch it, and I'd be like, 5:15, let's watch some Game of Thrones. Just watch it on demand.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I started telling everybody, and they all started doing that. They're like, that doesn't work. I'm pretty sure that doesn't work. I was like, well, I'm doing it, so clearly it works.
I don't have a VPN or proxy, so that's funny.
Like I said, my only question is that going to become more of a thing where companies are going to be like, oh, this is an opportunity to be able to inject commercials either at the beginning or the end, so we're going to live stream the first airing of stuff. I agree.
I think Netflix too would be smart to get in on some of that. Like you said, when it first comes out, which I don't know, maybe it doesn't matter.
Well, but. And what would be great is that, like, especially with something like Game of Thrones, where there's always spoilers and everybody gets so excited about it and like angsty about it, and have a place where everybody could quote unquote live stream it together and talk about it like a football game. You know, because that's one of the biggest complaints is that everybody will watch Game of Thrones and then go on Facebook and do a status update of, oh my gosh, I can't believe such and such died, which I'm always like, you can't believe such and such died? They kill literally everybody. You shouldn't be surprised at this point.
But when I've heard weird things about like Stranger Things heads in the opposite direction. So obviously I haven't watched it, but I hear it's only like 8 hours long. And right. Like, the problem is it's short, semi-problem. The issue, whatever, is that it's, like, 8 hours, and so you can pretty much binge-watch it pretty easily. And so you don't actually talk about the individual things anymore. You tend to talk about it as it's an eight-hour movie, essentially.
Right.
And you lose a lot of those small, like, I don't know, will they make it out? Is that strange or is it not? I have no idea what it's about. But anyways.
Is that a stranger clearly. Thing or a less or stranger just thing?
Strangest thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. But I'm like, live streaming. That's where it's at. That's which is a form of broadcast.
Right. Just a live broadcast. It's really interesting that you point that out about Stranger Things, because I forced myself to watch it in four segments over the course of like a week and a half. Mm-hmm. And so there was pondering and stuff. And it was funny because my girlfriend was over and I was like, I heard the show's kind of good. I was listening to the Weekly Planet podcast and they were just like raving about it. I was like, this is pretty good. We should watch the first episode. And she was like, this is creeping me out. I don't know. I'm really glad somebody's here to watch this with me, because I don't think I could watch this on my own. We watched the first two episodes and then like I didn't watch it again for like a couple of days, and I was like, oh, she's busy, like I kind of want to watch it. I'll just be like, hey Diana, do you mind if I like watch another episode of Stranger Things without you? She's like, I already finished it.
Yes.
I was like, oh gosh, well fine, I'll watch it on my own. But it's pretty good.
I don't mind.
Yeah.
So, that's awesome.
Yeah. But it's you know, it's funny because, I mean, the nature of live streaming and how that works, I think the communal conversation is going to be a big thing. And having everybody watch at the same time really helps. And that's where I think somebody like Twitter is in a great position, because they're all about the communal conversation, short blips, and you start with sports. But I think, like you said, if you can kind of get that conversation going, what would be really smart for Hulu and Netflix is to either A, work Twitter into your service and like embed it as part of the process, or just create your own, and Netflix Twitter for Netflix.
Seriously. Yeah.
That's it's actually happening. The more I think about it, the more it's kind of surprising that Netflix hasn't done that, like a forum thing, because they've got the technology to do that. It's not like that would be hard for them.
Yeah, I would love to see like some sort of second screen thing, like Nintendo, honestly.
Yeah, I could see like a companion app, like if you've got, you sign in, and if you've got a show playing on any device, the phone will automatically be like, oh, you're somebody's watching, I don't know, Voltron. Somebody else is watching Stranger Things.
Which is a good choice.
And, you know, which one do you want to talk about? And you can click on it and you can get all forumy up. Seriously, why doesn't... So can we build that in? Did we just give away a great app idea, James? Did we do it again? I feel like, you know, I feel like there's an API for this somewhere. Oh, my gosh. I think we might have just... I think
Netflix is in Los Gatos. You could work there.
I could work there. It's pretty nice. It's nice. They're actually...
That is pretty nice.
They're setting up new offices in a location that I used to work. They tore it down, built it up again. Mm. You know where that one like super nice gym is? It costs like $400 a month.
No.
In Los Gatos. That's ridiculous.
Shockingly, they didn't have enough patrons to stay open.
No. See, that's the thing. It's Los Gatos, so they do. Oh, yeah. Wow. It's like a castle. The place is so nice. I remember going inside of it once and not knowing what I was doing. But it was like a cavernous, like giant facilities everywhere. Nothing was like, it was all like half empty. And you're like, but super nice equipment. And in retrospect, it feels like, well, how could they possibly keep open until you realize how much it costs to go there? And you're like, oh, that's right. They're basically, it's for your like super rich executives that are like, I don't want anybody around in my giant gym. But it's pretty nice. The life of the rich and powerful. It's like right across from you. Since you don't know where I'm talking about, this doesn't help the conversation at all. But the new Netflix facilities is right across from that.
Got it. Perfect. Dialed in. All right.
It's cool. Very cool. So Intel is trying not to be terrible anymore.
Oh, my gosh. They're trying so hard.
They're shaking it up. And I'll be honest. I'm kind of excited. I've been on the Intel's not such a disaster train for a year. They've been getting their act together. They've been doing more that I've been optimistic about. And I'd say this week you're really starting to see the fruition of a new direction that I think is very positive for the company. And kind of
a conference this last week, right?
Yes. So they made a bunch of announcements. It's a conference that's similar to the F8 conference or Google I/O or the one that Apple does.
Whatever that is. Yeah.
Exactly. WWDC. So the first we're gonna get this right out of the way because it's time for our weekly VR update.
Yes.
So Intel announced a new Project Alloy. And this thing's pretty cool. It's a wireless VR headset for merged reality. It kind of just like kind of takes all the cool technologies and puts them into one package. And the idea being here that they're kind of trying to just jump to where we're going. What are we getting to? What are we getting at? And it's exactly what it sounds like. Mm. It's kind of like the HoloLens.
And I like that they didn't use HP's trademark trend of blended reality.
Yes, there we go.
they managed to tiptoe that one.
Exactly. Well, merged reality, I guess, is it mixed reality that the Magic Leap guys are going with? We're creating mixed reality. I think I finally figured out why people are excited.
With a source and start trademarking some of these things.
That'd be awesome. what was the Magic Leap, that company that's raised like $1 billion and they...
Yeah, who's full of themselves. Yeah.
Yeah, I hate them. I think I finally figured out why people are excited about it.
Do you hate Magic Leap more or less than Snapchat? Just I know. I think Magic Leap more. But
I think Magic Leap more because at this point, Snapchat like actually is like... I dislike their CEO so much I can't stand
that. And I think you secretly think Snapchat's done, and so you're okay with.
Yeah. Well, it's and I just feel like they came by their $1 billion. Like there's actual value that they're adding that they've proven. They like customers. I've said many times. Like I think the whole ephemeral message was a brilliant thing and very well done. Whereas Magic Leap is just. I don't even get it, and their CEO is so full of stuff. It's ridiculous. But they've gotten billions of dollars, so I think I figured it out. Basically, what it is they have a lens that shoots lasers into your eyeballs, and And as because of how they produce light, when your eye focuses on different things, the things in the lens blur the way they would at if as though they were at some specific depth. Okay. Whereas with like VR or the HoloLens, those things blur out of focus as though the depth right in front of your face. So in order to get them to blur properly, as though you're like not focused on the thing right in front of your eye anymore, they have to artificially blur it, which is impossible. Like you just can't do that. So it's something that everything always kind of has an artificial sharpness to it or extra blur based on whether you're looking, whether your eye's focused on it right up front or not, which allows a company, I guess what the selling point of Magic Leap is going to be is this like things where your eye focuses and where it sees depth is going to feel very natural. Now, why that means the company's worth $1 billion, I have no idea, because it doesn't seem that they've got anything that nobody else has in like world sensing or depth sensing or software. Like all they've got is these stupid lenses, but I guess, you know, who am I to question them? It's not my money. I don't care. But anyways, back to Intel, a company I'm actually excited about. Basically, what they did was they took all of these different technologies, because you got like the Vive, you've got the Oculus, and they're just essentially motion trackers with like really high quality OLED screens in front of your eyeballs. Okay. And then you plug that into a computer and they almost act like a monitor. Where they get back about orientation, but they're basically, they don't do any of the processing of the video image. Then you've got things like the Samsung Galaxy VR thing and Google's whole Daydream project, which is you put all the computational power into the screen, into the motion tracker, and it all works really well. But that tends to be very low powered and it doesn't have great graphics. Then you've got the Windows HoloLens, which kind of blends the both, where it's got a bunch of processing on board. It's got really powerful depth sensing. It's a transparent screen, so you could see the world around you automatically, and so they can overlay things over top the real world. But they can also stream from other devices wirelessly, like your Windows 10 device or your Xbox One, which allows just a lot of flexibility. So effectively, what the Project Alloy is it's using a couple of different technologies, but it's like a traditional VR where you're putting a screen in front of your eyeballs. It's got a lot of Intel chips in there, so it's a full-blown computational thing. It can do all the motion tracking in itself. It can do all the image generation in itself. It doesn't require an outside source. Kind of like the smartphone stuff. So that kind of, it gives you a sense of what sort of graphics level we're talking about here. But it also goes further in how it senses the world around you. It uses their real sense technology, which is similar to the Xbox Kinect, where it can do depth sensing. It's actually the technology that Microsoft didn't use for the Xbox Kinect. But it can also has a camera on it. So it can take images from the real world, overlay virtual images on that world because it understands everything in the depth field and then puts it up to your eyeballs right away. And this is just kind of there moving forward. The cool part about this to me is Intel is going to be really good at making high power, like high performance, low energy consumption chips for all of this. That's where they excel, is putting low power consumption and just doing a lot of cycles of processing. That's something that Samsung can't necessarily do or Google can't necessarily do because they don't control the silicon. They have to buy the screens. Intel has to buy the screens, but at this point, everybody's buying the screens. So it's pretty equal footing there. And they've spent a tremendous amount of money on this real sense technology, trying to develop and grow this infrastructure for these depth sensing cameras, because they think that there's a real future there for that. And so they've really been pushing that, which is interesting because that follows up the next announcement that they made, where they have a real sense. It's called Project Euclid. They really like these project names. And it's a real sense module for robots. Basically, things cool. It's like, it's like an entire computer built into this little device. It's based on the Intel's RealSense perceptual computing technology. It's a small candy bar sized stick that brings sensors to any robots, and Intel CEO Brian Krasnick during the company's keynote. It runs Linux and has an Atom processor, a RealSense camera, motion sensors, onboard communication capabilities, and detachable battery. Basically, it's meant to bring a bunch of things needed to build robotics into a small, self-contained PC. So, like, a lot of projects, like robotic projects nowadays, will use, like, Raspberry Pi as the heart of it. All your computation right. will be going on there. But if you want sensors, if you want like an accelerometer, you want a gyroscope, you want a barometer, you want wireless, you know, Wi-Fi or whatever, like a lot of times you have to buy those things and integrate them separately. If you want cameras, if you want depth sensors, you have to buy those and integrate it separately. Intel's basically saying, look, we got this nice little self-contained thing that does all that for you. And it uses all of this RealSense technology. So you've got just inherent depth understanding that you can bring to your robot, which is pretty cool. It's going to be available in the first quarter of 2017. It uses current generation of Intel's RealSense camera, not the upcoming RealSense 400. So it's last generations, but still, that's pretty huge for the hobbyist and developer community, just be able to jump in and have a really, really powerful heart of your robot and brain of your robot for understanding. Then at that point, it's all about take the brain, take all the sensing and attach whatever other arms and muscles and electrical stuff that you want. So it's pretty exciting, and it's Intel. So it's a, you know, it's a well-manufactured package. It's not
right.
You know, it's not an open circuit board, and it looks nice. It works well. It's exciting. Only problem with a lot of this stuff is that it's expensive, which brings me to the Joule Dev Kit. Intel's new Joule system can help gadgets see and understand the world. So as part of like a part of bringing all of these different pieces together, they've introduced a module called Joule, a tiny this thing is a tiny board for developers designed to bring powerful computer vision technology to cheap and easy to make prototypes. So the idea here is it's sort of like it reminds me of not a Raspberry Pi, but the form factor of an Arduino, or it's a board. It's kind of open. It's got the Joule chip in it, and this thing is just packed with sensors and Ooh. Computational power. It's pretty impressive. Let me pull up what it comes with. The Intel Joule 570X model features a high-performance 64-bit 1.7 gigahertz quad-core Intel Atom processor with bursts up to 2.4 gigahertz, which is beastly for that form factor. It's got 4 gigs of RAM, which is insane. For that, it has an Intel HD wow. graphics with 4K video capture and display.
There you go.
Which is like, you're blowing my mind here, guys. It's got 802 Wi-Fi with a Bluetooth 4.1, so it's got the most advanced wireless communication, USB 3.0 with MPI, like all your different interface options. It's Linux-based OS is tailored for the Internet of Things and smart devices. And it's enhanced to support the Intel RealSense camera and libraries. It's just, yeah, it's a beast. It sounds so cool. it's like it basically everything that I've just described to you, whether we're talking the Raspberry Pi or the Arduino or anything like that along those lines. This is basically Intel coming along and saying, look, these are cool, they're interesting, and they're very affordable. But if you want something that's like really powerful, then you're going to want to go with this. If you need some real computational horsepower, this is what you got to do. but you're not messing around because the thing costs $370.
Ooh, okay,
yeah,
okay,
exactly. It's not a joke. But for a lot of, you know, for a lot of projects, this makes great sense. If you need a full blown computer with a lot of power and just really sophisticated sensors, really sophisticated interfaces, this is the direction you want to go. This isn't a hobbyist learning how to and prototyping something that you can sell on Kickstarter. This is a prototyping board for industrial use, for companies that are going to be selling, you know, products that cost thousands and tens of thousands of dollars, which is pretty cool. And it, and to me, it's like, this is what I love seeing Intel do, where they introduce all sorts of different levels of these sorts of packages that just nobody else can build this. This is not something that Raspberry Pi could, that the Raspberry Corporation could ever do. This right. isn't something that Arduino could do. Not at this scale, not with this sort of sophistication. There's pretty much only one company that has all the intellectual property to do the circuitry, to do the chip design, and the manufacturing capabilities to bring it to that form factor and that power consumption level. Like, this is, this is where Intel is awesome. And so it's exciting to see that. They're also,
so when are you getting one for 370?
Oh jeez, I don't know. Probably probably sometime after I buy my later, exactly. Not right
buy
away.
Your VR headset.
Exactly.
I gotcha.
So there's two more things that we found out that Intel kind of, that in, they didn't actually announce at the conference, but they were tangentially related. Number one, Intel, they're all about the USB-C headphone.
Really?
Yeah. They were basically, they came out and said, look, you know, there have been some limitations to USB that has made it so that USB headphones don't make much sense for mobile applications. But a lot of those things have been, have been lessened. Number one, power consumption is a huge thing, I guess. With the 3.5 millimeter headphone jacks, are very, very, very low power consumption. And you just couldn't get that with previous forms of USB. Whereas just the nature of the USB-C protocol, they're basically coming out and saying, hey, USB-C, it's right there. It's nominal, the difference between the power consumption of the USB versus the headphone jack. It's also thinner than the 3.5 millimeter headphone jack, which if you're building a super small mobile device and you're trying to cram every ounce, you know, every nook and cranny with something, that's a big deal. Because number one, the thing already has a USB plug, so it's nice to not have to have an additional plug. But right. even if you only had one, it's still a smaller plug. So they're making the argument that for like your Walkman, it's going to make more sense to have it as a USB. But then the other thing that, like, another piece of this puzzle is, like, okay, what can you do more than sound? Obviously, noise-canceling headphones are a super expensive product. But one of the reasons why that is because in order to do noise-canceling, what you have to do is essentially you have speakers on the headphone or very near the headphone that takes sound in, creates, processes it, and creates the waveform in inverse and cancels the, like, so you have the sound coming through the headphone from the outside, and then the headphone produces an opposite waveform that cancels out that noise and makes it all silent. And then all that's left is the sound of the music coming in. Well, there's a lot of processing power that's needed to do that. That's either built to directly into the headphones or into a separate processing block. And one of the reasons why your iPhone doesn't have noise canceling built into it is because the microphone, in order to get sound from your mic to the iPhone and back to your headphones, takes too long to convert it into a digital set. Yeah. And in order to turn it into a digital signal, process it, create an inverse, add it to the music, and then send it back. It just doesn't work. Whereas what they're saying is with the USB-C, there's no reason to think it won't work. There's no reason to think that we can't just all of a sudden turn all headphones into noise canceling headphones using the microphone on your phones, which is pretty cool. And then they also said that just for even like beyond that, whether you're going into like video output, you can't do full HD video output with USB-C, but you can do video output in ways that you never could. like low scales, like low resolution stuff. And they're just like, look, guys, I know you like your 3.5 millimeter headphones, but they're super lame. Like they're just not that good. Trust us for a second. We're not doing this just to rip you off. They're actually better, which
it's a combination.
Yeah, a little combo.
No, it's probably genuinely better. I get it.
Right, and so I say all this to say this is the argument that you'll probably hear somebody like me making on September 9th when Apple announces their next iPhone that doesn't have a headphone jack. And honestly, to me, I hadn't heard of this. And I think if this is Apple's, if Apple does this, I just think it would be pretty cool if they sat there and said, look, all headphones that work with our iPhones now have noise canceling if you plug them in.
Just build it in
on a system level. There's noise canceling. And that's only possible because we can monitor the microphone next to your headphones, and it gives us the ability to do that. It'd be a huge selling point. And I think a lot of people would feel like, whoa, you're going to give me a pair of headphones that I can, like, earbuds that I can plug in and it'll just work. Okay, I'll allow it. So I think, you know, in a lot of technologists are going to be like, that's lame. You could still do it anyways, but whatever. I think those are the sorts of arguments you'll hear. Intel's helping them out a little bit with that. And the last piece of this big was a kind of a big deal announcement that they did. They announced it, but they didn't want to make a big deal about it, which is Intel is going to start manufacturing ARM based chips, which just a few
can't beat them, join them.
Pretty much. It was just a few years ago, Intel was in negotiations with Apple to build Apple chips in Intel foundries. And Intel's stipulation was we'll build chips that you design. Like Intel has never built chips other than chips that they've designed. Whereas like Samsung, the Taiwanese semiconductor manufacturing company, TSMC, those companies are called fabless manufacturers. So Apple would design a chip, then sends it to Samsung, sends it to TSMC, and those companies then make it at their foundries. Intel has only ever made Intel chips at Intel foundries. So it was a big deal that they were even talking to Apple about making Apple-designed chips at their foundries. But Intel's requirement, which ended up being too much for Apple, was you have to use some Intel intellectual property. Like instead of using the ARM architecture, you have to use the x86, but you can put your own graphics cores, your own power consumption stuff into it. And Apple said, heck no. And
is heck no techno.
Exactly. They, I already did it once this show, so I was trying to.
All right. Fair enough.
But they went back to, so they didn't use Intel, they use Samsung and TSMC. But Intel has now announced that, in a big change, like you said, if you can't beat them, join them. They are going to open up their foundries to other fabless, as a fabless manufacturer. So basically say companies can come in, whoever they negotiate with can use Intel's processes. Why this is a huge deal is because Samsung and TSMC are the most competitive manufacturers to Intel in the world. And they're at 14 nanometer processes. Intel's at 11, which is a lot smaller at the scale we're talking about. Power consumption is inherently lower. Speeds are inherently faster when you get to that size. And so you can use literally the exact same processor design, make it in an Intel fab, and it will be smaller, use less electricity, and run faster, which is a pretty big deal. And since chip designs don't stay stagnant, they'll keep developing more and more and more. And this will be huge for whoever gets there. It's too late for Apple to do it for this generation of chips. It's probably too late for Apple to do it before 2019. But I wouldn't be surprised at all if you saw Apple team up with Intel in the next, before the end of the decade, to build chips for your iPhones and iPads.
Yeah, probably been seeing them in a bunch of Android devices too.
I agree. So pretty cool stuff.
Yeah. Wow. Awesome. Ton of stuff going on. So shifting gears dramatically here.
Yeah, I'd say.
We're going to talk about dishwashers for half a second.
I'm excited. Do you own a dishwasher at your new place?
Yes.
Garbage disposal?
The layout is not very good. But yes, we also have a garbage disposal. It's actually a really nice garbage disposal. It's super quiet. Okay. I almost replaced it, but it turned out it was the light switch that was busted instead. So it was an easy fix.
Nice.
Yeah, but it turns out that the dishwashers are not actually, like, I don't want to say it. They're popular. They're in 75% of American households, but they're nowhere near refrigerators and microwaves, which are over 95% each.
Right.
Do you have a dishwasher in your place?
Sort of. We have a dishwasher. It just doesn't work.
Oh. It's interesting you don't feel the need to go out and replace it. Unlike if a refrigerator broke.
Yeah.
You'd make it a day.
Right.
Be freaking out the entire time.
Yeah, exactly. Is your refrigerator running?
You better go catch it.
There was something on Reddit, and it was a political slogan. Like, it looked like it was designed for a bumper sticker. And I'm going to look it up.
Okay. But... dishwashers are kind of it's interesting. The argument was that it represents a technology that was supposed to take off and help revolutionize the home, and it just never really did. And I think you're going to find that it will work as a good analogy for a lot of other tech stuff that we're talking about. So some examples here is measure the popularity of a product by its tech adoption. And so one of the things that you can do is you look at the time that it takes a product to get from 5 to 50%. Does that make sense? So you don't necessarily start at zero, because that first 5%, it can be a little weird. But once you hit 5 to 50, like, how long does it take? So let's see here. Some examples is for the TV, it took 5 years for it to go from 5 to 50.
Okay.
For the refrigerator, it took a little bit over a decade.
All right.
For the dishwasher, it took almost 40 years to happen.
40
and
years.
And it's still only at 75%. And that, by the way, was in 1997 that it crossed the 50% mark.
Wow. It really isn't that. I mean, we grew up without one for the longest time.
Yeah. And we thought we were weird, but it turns out, no, we were actually normal.
That is really fascinating.
Almost just half the other country, if you think thinking about when we flipped the switch.
That's crazy. Why?
Let's see here. In 1971, 18% of households had an automatic dishwasher, 83% had refrigerators, and 71% had washing machines. So the dishwasher, the lowly dishwasher, is a neglected tech that just doesn't seem to take off like you would expect.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because it's like, I'm not even sure why, but I have never felt the need to have a dishwasher. I just, like, and maybe it's because I'm an unmarried dude that, yeah, single, that I don't have a lot of dishes to do. And so it's like, oh, I'll just make it work. It's fine. But it's, you know.
I think the other issue it's like with a clothes washer. Yeah. You toss your clothes in, throw the soap in, hit the go button, and walk away.
Right.
Like a dishwasher, you can't do. You shouldn't do that.
Right.
You actually have to kind of do the pre-wash thing. You have to set them in. Got to play a little Tetris. And then, I don't know about what yours used to work, but mine, like our new one, it's like a 90-minute cycle. I'm like, what in the world is it doing for an hour and a half?
Right.
Like, this, it, honestly, look, I get 45 minutes. I'd prefer to see half an hour.
Yeah.
90? Going, at least it's not me doing it, I guess. But how much water am I using right now?
Right, yeah. I just don't know about... I don't know about that. It's a fascinating... Yeah, it's hard for me to even try to come up with, an explanation for it, because I'm just... To me, it just seems so natural to be like, no, I don't need to do it. And then there's all sorts of problems with dishwashers, right? They you don't get with, a clothes washer machine. Number one, when they dry and there's soap scum on your plates and stuff, and they don't seem clean, drives me nuts. It's just I know they're clean.
More commentary on the soap you use, but yeah.
Fair enough, but I never have that problem with my clothes.
Fair enough. Okay. All
right. Or I very, very rarely take my clothes out of the dryer and go, well, this isn't clean. it's an oil stain, or it smells bad still, or something. And usually another wash or
it's an exception. Yeah.
Exactly. Whereas with a lot of times with washing machines, it feels like it's the rule. Like you said, that's right. There's also the pre-work element, I think, is a big thing, too. It's the fact that you
can't. Well, it's funny. They showed this ad. It was the dream dishwasher in 1962. And it was this idea of a conveyor belt that you just are putting your dishes on, and it kind of magically goes in and then pops out clean the other side. Right. And I was like, that's kind of what we were promised in 1962. And in some ways it's a failed technology.
It really is. Well, even industrial dishwashers, where I don't know if you've ever done a dishwashing job before. They are awesome. When I was in college,
that's what I want. They're so fast, but well, they're still
working. You're right, but there's a caveat here, because it's when I was in college, my fraternity had we had our own kitchen and our own chef, which was really cool. But a couple of us had to be the hashers. We had to do all the cleaning and everything. And at the time I was the president, and so I volunteered nobly to serve my fraternity. Also, I was broke and they were willing to pay me $10 an hour to do it. So it was yeah. It was ridiculous though, because the girls, all the sororities, they had male hashers. They would hire fraternity men to go into their house and do all their dishes and serve all their food. Because we had to do it ourselves, which I think is a testament to how broke we were as a fraternity. But I, which is, once again, how did I end up having to do dishes for my brothers, whereas my brothers ended up doing dishes for the girls? This is ridiculous. How did I get the short end of the stick on this? Anyways, but there was a huge amount of work involved in cleaning, rinsing, and preparing the dishes to go into the really fast dishwasher. And if you did it wrong, it didn't work. And you were using kind of heinous chemicals, it felt like, for disinfecting and cleaning.
Yeah, that's true.
And there was the amount of work involved in the industrial dishwashers is still really high. It's a horrible job. That's always the lowest rung job, right? The dishwasher. That's the person who has, and yet they're not sitting there scrubbing it. Their whole cleaning it by hand. Their job is to throw it into the automated machine that will wash it for them. And yet that's the lowest rung job, partly because it's simple, it doesn't require a lot of skills, but also partly because it's horrible.
Right.
And I wonder if it's just the nature of the process, where it's by definition, clothes, most of the time, we don't want to stain it. We don't want to do whatever. So we take care of our clothes. So our clothes have a little bit of sweat, a little bit of grime on them when we throw them into the dishwasher or the washing machine generally. And so they're already kind of clean. They're like a rinsed bowl getting thrown into the dishwasher. You're just doing a little disinfecting, putting a little soap on it, getting rid of the last layer of scum. Whereas because of the nature of food and dishes come fully soiled before they get to the dishwasher. And then you've got the back end of it is I feel like I've already rinsed it. I feel like I've already done 90% of the work of cleaning it. All I'm going to do is throw a little soap on it by hand and then throw it in the washing rack. I'm 90% of the way there. I feel like by the time I get to that point, it's not that much worse. And I cleaned it. I know how clean it is. I don't feel like there's some black magic voodoo going on inside the machine where it's spraying water and steam and stuff. And what's the soap doing? And did the bowl flip upside down, or was something in the way? I don't like dishwashers, man. I get it.
It's failed tech.
It's a completely failed tech. You know what the answer is?
No.
This is going to be like, you will know that the robotic revolution is over when we have the first really successful dishwashers.
Hmm.
Where they're just fully, they're articulated arms in water and scrubbing units, and they can use, you just give it anything and it will clean it. Any shape, any material. Wood. You can't dishwash wood because the wood soaks up too much water. It's bad for the grain. You got to wash it by hand. Things that once there's a robot that can do all of your dishes as though it's washing it by hand because it has the processing power to be able to understand what it is that it's picking up and doing. It's got the articulation and the mechanical ability, like at an affordable enough price to be able to do it. It can sense for cleanness. I don't know, like use lasers or something. Blast it with UV light. I feel like it's completely failed. And I feel like the answer, I don't feel like there's like a middle ground answer there either for between how can we quicken this? How can we automate this in a better way? I feel like you need to go to full on highly automated, like relegated to the most advanced factories type of automation right now to do dishwashing at an automatic level. I can't even think. You know, it's funny. I will spend the next week actively trying to come up with better ideas, trying to see if there's a solution. Just because, at first blush, a lot of times when I talk about automation, like I come up with like five different things. Like you could do this, you could do this, you could do this, you could do this. Like this is where the technology goes. Whereas with like dishwashing, I can't think of anything. I dishwash all the time, so it's not like it's a process I'm unfamiliar with,
right.
Which might be the problem. You know, somebody who's really into cooking hamburgers might and knows all the intricacies of making the meat and making the bread might be the exact wrong person to ask to automate the hamburger manufacturing process because they're too into the nuances to be able to step back and say, how can we have a robot do this?
Curse of knowledge.
Yeah. It's
a killer.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting problem.
Anyways, there you go.
How much time do we have left?
10:15.
Okay. Cool. Then I'll do these stories because they're kind of interesting. So you really liked this a couple of months ago. The Airlander 10, a.k.a. the Flying Butt, took flight this week.
Cool.
Yeah, the Flying Bum.
So big.
It's enormous. The Airlander 10, for those of you who don't remember, is the world's largest aircraft and also happens to look like a human butt from certain angles. It's taken flight for the first time. It's a helium-filled blimp with a bunch of different large fans on it and wings. It's awesome. It's a massive 302 feet long, filled with helium. And because helium leaks at a very slow rate, around 10% per year without holes, it's capable of remaining in flight up to 3 weeks at a time. The aircraft has not yet been tested for commercial use, but it's capable of carrying 10 metric tons of cargo, a far heavier load than a conventional aircraft can manage using less fuel. 10 metric
it's tons, so
2 pounds.
Big.
2 pounds is that? I was going to say, I knew that wasn't 2,000 or 20,000 pounds. It's 22,000 pounds of stuff.
Okay.
It's a huge
11 tons, U.S. tons.
Yes. Correct.
Dude, that's sweet. Okay, yeah. So they got their, they did their test flight or whatever. And it's successful.
Yeah, met all of the test objectives, which include safe takeoff, landing, and a series of gentle turns at increasing speed. It flew to a height of 500 feet and reached a speed of 35 knots during the course of its 19-minute ride, which ended just before sunset.
Ah. That's pretty sweet.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I like it. I'm a big fan of blimps, so I'm a big fan of this,
this helium butt.
Exactly.
So,
looks awesome. Yeah. Yeah, it's
when do they think it'll be commercially ready to go, did it say?
Let's see here. HAV plans to design an aircraft that can carry 5 times more weight than the Airliner 10 by 2020, according to ABC. No, it doesn't say.
Where does one land a giant butt-shaped helium tank? Anywhere flattish will do, is the answer.
Yeah, which is kind of, I mean, that's one of the big selling points, is that it doesn't need a full runway because it's, you know, a blimp.
Yeah.
So it can do pretty aggressive takeoffs and landings. Yeah, that's cool. I'd love to see a bunch of these flying around doing all sorts of cool stuff. If you go to their website, we'll link this article, and they actually have a video of the Airlander 10 doing its basically somewhat vertical takeoff. I mean, for a vehicle that large, it's crazy how it just sort of like it kind of picks up and all of a sudden it's off the ground and flying. That's so awesome. I want one.
Speaking of awesome, GoldenEye 007, an awesome video game, has an unofficial multiplayer remake.
Really?
Graphics. For free.
Ooh. Hey, now. Do I need my Nintendo 64, the classic gaming system that it was built for?
No, you don't, actually. You can download it onto a computer.
Ooh.
And play right on that. So we will have a link to it. And yeah, you'll be able to go download it. I haven't checked to see if it's available for Mac. Probably just PC is my guess. But which is what I plan to put it on. Here we go. Recommended specs. Windows XP.
All right, that's nice.
4 gigabytes of RAM.
That's not bad.
And yeah, that's about it. Okay.
Really? It's awesome. I wonder. Unfortunately, there's no single player mode. I'm not surprised. I wonder how.
Yeah, it's multiplayer.
Ooh. I wonder if all they did was, I wonder if they updated any of the mechanics of the game at all, or if they just went through and updated the overhauled visuals is one of the catchphrases, or one of the, like, the things that it says.
I think it was mostly overhaul of visuals. It looks good.
Yeah. And just watching them play, it does seem very GoldenEye-esque. There's a bit of ragdoll physics, which makes me wonder. I can't remember what it was like when. Oh my gosh, it's been so long since I played this game. This does look good.
It's I had a fun. TV, I would play it tonight. But
I love. Oh my gosh, they did the slappers.
Dude, some blood comes off when you do the slapper.
I know. 10 game modes. Please tell me you got DK mode.
Who knows?
This is a brutal game. That's a fun game. You remember back when we did that story with where the creator, the Nintendo creator, wanted at the end of the game during the credits, James Bond to go to the hospital where everybody would still be alive, and like it was just what a weird company. Oh my gosh, that's awesome. That's really cool. Okay, so my last story for today: China has. Launched a satellite that is designed for hack-proof communications. It's kind of interesting. It uses quantum technology. So do you know how traditional encryption works?
You take a number, you scramble it, then you unscramble it on the other side. Somehow there's a key that tells you how you scrambled it.
Exactly. So this idea is there are certain equations that are really easy to solve one way and hard to solve another way. For example, it's really easy if you have a solved Sudoku problem, it's really easy to check it. But if you have an unsolved Sudoku problem, it's really hard to complete it. From a computational perspective, one is trivial, the other is far from it. There's a lot of problems like that and of different forms, and that's an analogous to how encryption works. It's basically if you have the actual number that you're scrambling everything by, it's really easy to work it backwards. But if you don't, it's really, really hard. And this is where this key, like the idea of, you know, the FBI wanted Apple to unlock the iPhone. What they literally wanted Apple to do is to generate, to create the key that, to find that number that would allow them to go in and decrypt all of this information. How you pass that key around, how it exists, there's this idea of a public key that allows you to encrypt it, but it requires a private key to decrypt it, which allows for a lot of, allows for you to send me an encrypted message that only I can decrypt. There's a bunch of different like systems for doing this, but ultimately all of these problems, they are solvable. That is one of the problems with encryption is that ultimately you can, given enough time and computational power, you can reverse engineer the key that's used to encrypt it and then decrypt everything. The bigger the key, the more bits involved in the key, the longer it takes, but the more computational power you have, the easier it is. And with the advent of quantum computers, which seem to be coming faster than anybody realized was going to happen, there's going to be a steep drop off on how effective that traditional sort of encryption works. So scientists and computer technologists have come up with a system for quantum encryption, and the idea is that when you have photons, you have they have a couple of different polarized states, and those happen at a quantum level, whether they're up and down, left, right, or at different diagonals. And then using different polarizers, you can kind of measure what the polarization of these different photons are at. And actually, I was watching a YouTube video by Physics Girl, where she explained kind of how it works with photonic light and stuff. And as far as we knew, the ability to transmit and this sort of quantum information so that you can encrypt using this quantum data. So the idea being here that that quantum data, these photons and the state that they're in, you can use that. You can send that key and you can use that key to encrypt data. And because it's truly randomized, like by the nature of physics, it's not something you can work back. It's not something you can decrypt. So it's effectively hack proof. You can't put enough computational power to it because there's no pattern that it follows that you can work to use to decrypt, which is where the real advantage of that sort of technology comes from an encryption perspective. The other really nice part about it is during the transmission process of the quantum information from the sender to the receiver, if somebody interrupts it and measures it, due to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, you actually change the state of the quantum. You change the quantum state in that process. And so if for some reason there isn't a matching on both ends and there's certain mathematic models you can use to determine if there was an intruder, you can determine if your quantum information was sniffed, which means that you know if somebody else was there reading the information in the middle of it. So it's like, it's really robust. The biggest problem that we've had is that researchers have only been able to get it to work up to like a couple hundred kilometers, which doesn't really work well as a global communication system for encrypted data.
Yeah, that's not great.
Theoretically, it's there, but who knows? Well, China, I guess, doing their crazy China thing, decided they had figured it out. So they launched a satellite this week that has one of these quantum encryptors on it. The idea being you put it into space and it can communicate over long distances all around the world. And with a network of these satellites, you could be sending the quantum encryption keys everywhere that they need to be, quantumly encrypt the data, and then the data can transmit over normal means, but the NSA or whoever couldn't, or Russia or Great Britain, they wouldn't be able to read that information because it would be truly and welly encrypted by this cool satellite. So I'm sure if it works, we will be working feverishly to figure out how they did it and probably be sending up our own satellites, unless we already have and we just don't know about it because that secret information is encrypted, which would be nice. Be encouraging.
Huh. Interesting. But,
it's the future of encryption, man. Oh. I'm sure Google will be on it soon enough.
Like you said, it's coming fast.
Yeah. This quantum stuff's interesting. It really is. It's mind-blowing.
Is China hiring people?
It's China, yeah.
Just trying to help you out. Keep your options open.
I appreciate it.
Very cool. Very cool. Lots of good tech stuff. All right. I think we're ready to call it here. So, everybody, thank you for joining us, and thank you so much for listening to episode 256. I don't remember what the binary numbers were, but that's okay. Don't forget, you can check out all the show notes with all the links at forliberos.com/256. And if you'd like to get the show notes sent directly to you, we'll gladly email them to you. All you got to do is go to the webpage and sign up, and you can get those. And then finally, this podcast is supported by listeners just like you. So if you'd like to contribute, we have four different levels. You can be a fanboy, a nerd, junkie, or a maven, and they each have their own levels of reward, which is pretty sweet. And so again, just check out furloughrose.com for all of that information. I am James Furlough. My 30-year-old brother is Matthew Furlough. And so we will talk next time.